we are out to get the world investing successfully. This is a purpose-driven business. We're creating, as I said, a new generation, and our purpose simply is to inspire people to own their financial future. Because it's easy. There's no great mystery.
Welcome to episode 127 of the Entrepreneur Experiment podcast with me, Gary Fox. I just wanted to say that number out loud because it's good to remind ourselves how far we've come in the last couple of years. So thank you for being part of that journey. Today, we have one of the world's best stock picking experts, and he's Irish. So if you've got into stock trading, stock picking in the last year or so, as a lot of us have, you're going to love today's episode. I just want to say a quick thank you to my partners for season six, Kiri's Car Store. It's carstore.ie. We'll chat a little bit more about them later. In brief, they're the best place in Ireland to buy a used car. So go to carstore.ie and check them out. If you're a regular listener, I'd like you to do me one favor. Refer the pod to a friend of yours. You can now get rewarded. So go to the link in the description below, refer/experiment, and you'll be able to refer the pod to your friend. Now, on with today's episode. We are chatting to Emmett Savage, the founder of My Wall Street. These guys have had incredible results in the stock market in the last 10 years. We hear their story of how they started. We hear the power of technology and how it's democratized the creation of wealth. We hear about the importance of having a co-founder. And we talk a little bit about psychology, both of stock picking and also about building your company, how the power of perception and influence can play a massive role in your early success. Here is my chat with Emmett Savage, the founder of My Wall Street. Emmett, welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Gary. Delighted to be here.
We can go straight into this one because you're a pro.
Pro at what?
Emmett, welcome to the podcast. You are the founder of My Wall Street. What is My Wall
founder.
Street?
Thank you. A co-founder, Gary. There's co-founder. Two of us. There's the guy backstage and there's the guy front of stage. I'm the one front of stage, and John Terrell, my co-founder, is actually my Wall Street secret weapon, but I don't really tell him very often.
We'll keep it a secret. I won't tell anyone, don't worry. So you're the pretty face and he's the brains.
Oh, absolutely.
Lovely. Tell me about what you guys do.
My Wall Street's mission is to get the world investing successfully, because really, truly, Gary, like, we go through life and most of us learn from our parents how to make a living. And we have a template in our mind for how wealth is created, how wealth is generated. And for the vast, vast majority of people, that wealth, or the ability to create generational wealth, is inaccessible, because there's only a few ways to actually get rich. And one is you're born lucky, you inherit some money, you have a big win in the lotto, for example, you have a very highly sought after rare skill, like being a surgeon or a senior legal professional. But the one mechanism available to everybody is stock investing. It has democratized the chance to get wealthy. And when you apply a few rules, you can actually create generational wealth in your family. And My Wall Street was kind of born out of a realization that everybody should be investing, irrespective of where they came from. And I didn't come from wealth. And I certainly believe that this is the greatest opportunity for everyone to have something going in the background of their life while they make their way through their careers and actually have this thing that builds generational wealth.
We're going to get the secrets here. This is going to be one of the most high impact hours of people's lives. We're going to get the secrets to getting wealthy. I love that intro. And to be honest, it's something I've only started exploring in the last couple of years. I've only started taking it seriously and actually trying to educate myself. I kind of just went with the flow, I think, like a lot of people. And I think in Ireland, it's almost like a dirty word. Money was one of those things we didn't really talk about. You know, it's only in the last couple of years, I think, that we've all started being a bit more open. Information, like yourselves, have started kind of making it accessible to everybody. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I was born into a home, which I suppose modest home, like I think the vast, vast majority of Irish people were born into a modest home. It's only rarely to hear somebody had wealth when they were young, certainly at my age. So despite having a modest beginning, all my needs were always fully looked after. And my dad started to talk to me about stock investing at a very young age. And in fact, it was an uncle of his, so a granduncle of mine, went out to Australia in the 1940s or 50s and rang home to his family and said, you should buy shares in this mining company that I'm working for. And the family, they didn't even really know what he was talking about, but they figured it out and collected, you know, together some funds, and they bought shares in his, in a mining company that my granduncle had gone out to work for in Australia. And that was the beginning of the Savage family's foray into stock investing. And how that worked out is another story, but that's really what captured my dad's interest. And then when I was small, he used to explain to me the fundamentals, the rudiments of stock investing in very simple language. Because, I mean, he was no expert, but he understood what he knew and he was able to pass that on to me. And that kind of captured my attention, captured my interest. And I suppose you could say that was the kernel of my Wall Street.
I love that story. And you said a really interesting word there, expert. Finance and shares is one of those areas where everybody seems to be an expert. They know enough to be dangerous. And I think that's what confuses people, is that you hear so much information. It flows around you like water, and it can be often hard to discern, what do I do? I think it's overwhelming. So I think services like yourselves are just makes total sense. We've had an interesting year. I couldn't be talking to you at a better time. So we'll wrap up 2020 slash the craziness of 2021. It's only May and it feels like 10 years have happened in the last couple of months. But go back to when this started. Was this your first venture into shares professionally, or had you always been doing it from an early age?
Well, I suppose my first foray into shares were kind of like in the discussions with my father, which I mentioned. So there was this kind of, I felt an ownership of the decision points which my dad was making. So we'd talk about shares that he wanted to buy, and he'd go off and buy them, and I'd keep an eye on it, and we'd have that conversation. So it morphed, it slowly became my thing. And I think really the democratization of the stock markets truly was born when the internet became a thing, a tool for everybody. And for me, that was in college. So I was in DCU from 92 to 96 doing a degree in applied physics. And it was in college in DCU that I got my hands on a working internet browser. And it was in DCU that I started to explore the world of the US stock exchange systems, because these, like back in the mid 90s, Google wasn't born and Facebook wasn't born. And the vast, vast majority of websites we interact with today were not conceived or born yet. But Yahoo Finance was. Exactly when it launched, I'm not sure, but it was one of the first. And from those earliest days right through to now, Yahoo Finance has been the pillar of stock research for most people in the world. And it's changed very, very little in those 25 plus years. So I kind of started to do some light research in college. And then when I got my first job, I opened an online brokerage account. I'm going to say that was around 96 or 97. The company was called Daytech, DETEK.com. And Daytech.com was an online stockbroker. Up until that point, the only way that my father and I and anyone else in Ireland could buy shares in the New York Stock Exchange was to pick up a phone, dial a stockbroker in New York generally, and place an order. And it was very, very expensive. If you park the cost of the phone call to New York, which in its own right in an average Irish home was a drama. We had to, you know, ring up with the brokerage firm that I had it, or my dad had an account with, was Payne Weber, New York based broker. We dial up, and I think the commission was a minimum of $60, right up through to a percentage of whatever it is you'd invested. And that was just highway robbery. It was fundamentally wrong. Daytech came along. They said 10 bucks a trade, no matter what you're doing. And that was great. You could measure the damage of commission. And that was the late 90s. And very soon Daytech was acquired, I think by TD Waterhouse or by TD Ameritrade. It was a successive acquisition one after the next. And today it's TD Ameritrade. And I've had the same account with the same kind of user interface for 25 years. And that's really how, you know, where I began. But that's the what I did, and the how I did is almost a different story, because, you know, like for me, stock investing wasn't an interest. It was an absolute obsession. It has been my entire life. It isn't something I just do, you know, when I have a few free moments. I do it all the time. I wake in the night thinking about stock market. I read exhaustively on the subject. I write exhaustively on the subject. I think about it nonstop. And most of all, I do it nonstop. So you can kind of learn anything from a book. You can pick up a book and study the art of soccer. You can study the sport of soccer to the point where it's an art, but unless you get out there and start kicking a ball with other people, you know, you can read all you want. You have to learn by doing. And stock investing is very much in that ilk. You have to learn by doing. You learn by reading and then you learn by doing. And so I've been doing and I've been reading on the subject for 25 years. I've had a good degree of success and really the kernel, the breaking point for me was I fundamentally was discontented in big corporate life, like, which is a great life choice for the majority of those who choose it. But I was lucky enough to have a raw passion and hopefully a flair for stock investing that could never be fully expressed in the corporate world. So I just had to quit. I mean, when my own boss said to me, "You should start a business," in stock investing, you know, when my wife was saying, you have to give this a shot. When the people, you know, my own dad, who thankfully is still with me, you know, or with us rather, he doesn't live here. My dad was saying, you should do it. All the people were saying, do it, just do it, start something. And that's when I walked up to John Tyrrell in the middle of our big corporate job, in the middle of the street in our company. And I said, "John, I'm going to have to leave to start something. And you're the best I've ever worked with in the most complimentary way to me. Because John and I are very good at opposite things and we work so well together." So John said, "Right, I'm going home to speak to the wife." He went home and Moran, John's wife, is one of the people I feel most grateful to on this journey, because she, like all those people around me, said to John, "You can do it. I know you can do it." And we got the ball rolling. We hopped on a plane. We flew out to the Motley Fool in Alexandria, Virginia, who were our first investor. And their investment didn't just bring capital. It brought a huge, opened the doors to a library of expertise that we could never have developed in Ireland. But most of all, it gave us this belief. And it's that where the biggest player in the world has said, "Yes, we think you can do it." It has a transformative effect on your self-belief. It really does.
You covered a lot there. What were you doing? What were you and John doing that you...
So we were both in technology. We were both working in Vodafone.
Okay. And were you both obsessive about shares, or was this... were you doing it together already, or how did you know he was the one, I suppose, because that's the big question. Founder, yeah. No co-founder. What way do I do this?
Yeah, well, a friend of mine who I used to work with in Vodafone interviewed John in 1999, and I was heading up their radio engineering division, and she was heading up the core network engineering division. And she rang me and said, "I've just interviewed a guy who I think would be brilliant in your department." And I said, "Well, there's no openings." And she said, no, meet the guy. So I met John in the 90s. He was so impressive. He came in for a summer job, actually. And he was so impressive at that time, not just to me, but to the impact he had. He was extended what I believe to be the first and only scholarship, where they paid him during his final year of college on the promise he'd come back. Now, he took that cash. He'd love to know I'm telling you this story. He took that cash. He went to the Czech Republic and he spent it all on booze.
I thought you were going to say he bought an apartment or he went to a casino. Okay, standard Irish lad abroad.
You know, so, but he did come back and, you know, this the promise that he showed in his second last year of college, it was fully there. And he was on my team for a couple of years, and then he went off and ran his own department. And, you know, we just kind of drifted insofar as he was off doing work in one end of the business, I was in the other. But what we had found in each other was we identified in each other just inherently this kind of complementary way of thinking. Excuse me. So this, you know, to be great at something means you have a deficit in another area. And John is great at far more many things than I am. but I'm pretty good at a bunch of things that he's not necessarily an expert in. And I have spent, as I said, my life stock investing. So I'm the stock investing guy. John is the picture of operational excellence. Let's say even perfection, keeping an organization running like a Swiss watch. That's John's skill. I'm the CEO who has a total of zero direct reports. John and I speak daily, and the organization reports to John, who's the COO. And that's great. That actually, in its own right, expresses how we complement each other. I don't think managing people is beyond me, but I don't want to do it.
I love that self-awareness, because so few, I can count on the number of one hand, and it's zero, the amount of people that have said that to me, who are that frank and that self-aware to go, yeah, I could, but I don't wanna. I think we let ourselves go down this path of, oh, I'm CEO now, I must have everyone reporting to me, and I must have my finger in all the pies. I love that level of self-awareness. Was that the reason you brought John on board as a co-founder?
The reason that John was identified, or the way that John was identified, was my wife and I sat down, and it was apparent that I was just going to have to go and give this thing a shot. And she said, right, we're going to do an experiment. Write down the name of everyone you've ever worked with or interacted with who impressed you with their work ethos. It could be the person coming in to empty the waste paper basket. It could have been the CEO of Pepsi Cola. Anyone you know who has just knocked your socks off every time. And we sat down, we did a brainstorm of Fionnuala, threw down a few names, and I wrote down the names. And then she wrote in the center of page four attributes. And I think one was like big visionary thinking, operational excellence. I can't remember, actually. I still have that sheet of paper. But she said, look, I think you're those two. And I agreed. And she goes, let's figure of all the names you put down on this sheet, who are the other two? Who's strong in the other two? And without like discussing it, we both landed on John and said, John is perfect for this role. He has been like, this has been like, I wasn't joking at the outset when I said, like, he is my Wall Street secret weapon. You know, very often I'm asked the question by investors, well, what happens if you're hit by a bus? And I always say, ah, oh, they better get a new bus, ha ha ha. And then, in back of my mind, I'm like, you're asking the wrong guy.
Just download it to John. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, why did you not just go it alone?
Oh, I really absolutely believe that every entrepreneur, if possible, should find their equivalent of John Tyrrell. Because it is really hard to figure everything alone. Whereas if there's two of you, if you've co-founded something and you are a good fit, well then, believe me, the worries and the stress is more than halved, because you'll help each other. It's like you're maybe mountain climbing together. Like, why go it alone? Well, two is better than one. And that is, when I meet young entrepreneurs and they ask for advice, and, you know, there's a whole load of advice I can give, but one is try and find someone you utterly trust who's brilliant and co-found it. Don't found it, co-found it, because there will be days you're having an off day and she or he won't, and vice versa. And you will make sure that you're keeping each other in check and kicking each other's ass upwards all the time.
John's LinkedIn emails are exploding as we speak from this level of glowing recommendation. I'd say his ears
were gone from zero to one, yeah.
Wherever he is, his ears are burning.
Yeah.
What? So you then talked about, okay, you convinced John to come in. You're like, this is what we're going to do. What did you tell him you were going to do?
Well, I wasn't sure.
That's like, that's why I'm curious.
So we sat down, and so actually there's a little bit of a backstory. He and I had put an ad in the Irish Times. The Engineer's Journal about, I'm going to say 15 years ago. And it simply said, if you want to learn everything you want to know about stock investing, come to such and such a hotel in Leopardstown, in Ballsbridge, and bring a check for €300. And if you like it, you can pay on the way out. And if you don't like it, you don't have to pay. And about 20 people turned up. All 20 people put the check in the box at the back of the room at the end of the day. And he and I had organized that. I delivered the content. And, you know, most people know you learn by teaching. You know, when you decide you're going to teach something, you really have to have a very linear understanding. a sequential understanding of the subject you're talking about. You can't fudge over things, especially if it's a subject matter that is as important as one's personal finances. So people arrive, and we John and I, you know, pocketed a whole pile of cash, which we, by the way, subsequently donated to the charity Gold, because Irish guilt, you know, it's you know, it's a killer. Yeah. We didn't want to feel we were profiteering from those in our community. So we ran these courses, if you like, repeatedly. And then in 2008, I think the Irish economy hit the rocks. Interest in this course we were doing dried up. And we just went back to the day job. So we had worked with each other, and we had, by teaching and serving the people who attend this thing we were doing, identified a need. And the need was this, that people enjoy learning, but they love not having to think. The one thing everyone said at the end, where I'd stand up there and say, I'm going to tell you what a stock is. What is a share? What's a stock exchange? What's a stockbroker? Why do you need one? What's a good share? And the same question from every single course prevailed. Well, so what are you buying?
I knew that was what you're exactly going to say. I texted a genius friend of mine last night about DeFi, and I was like, look, I'm starting to understand it, but I need you to give me the four main What are we looking at here? Where do I start? Yeah. Because it's, again, it's overwhelming. But yeah, exactly. Don't make me think.
And that's not to say that we're dealing with a dumb world. We're dealing with a very intelligent world, and everyone has their own stuff to deal with. They have their own area of expertise. They have their own things to think about. And they simply, it's like, great, now I understand. So what should I do? Yeah. And we could see this was like an orchestra. Everybody was like, so what are you doing? So the way I dealt with that was I started a Twitter account with the padlock on it, ready to request access. And I said, look, I can't tell you what to do. That's a different business model. It's regulated. I can't tell you what to do, but I can tell you what I'm doing. And I, at that moment, decided to abandon this concept of privacy. And I tweeted every time I bought a share. So a few years later, and this went on for 5 years, I got an email in the inbox from somebody who is in one of those courses. And I didn't know who was in the room, frankly. I didn't care. It's like, there you are. Did you bring your check? Have a seat. And I got an email, and it was, dear Emmett, I attended your very first course in Ballsbridge, and I'd love to meet you to discuss the performance of your stock picks. And I won't say who this individual is, but he's a highly, highly influential individual who'd be very well known. And I met the guy, and
that's an ominous message to get, Emmett. That's a very ominous message.
Oh yeah. Hell, you better believe it, because I sat up straight when this arrived. I was like, what did I say now? And what have I done?
Yeah.
This individual is an expert in law. So I met him, and he said, look, no, just go get it checked. I honestly think you've got something good here. So through very generously, an individual in KPMG said, look, I'll take a look at your track history. It's not an audit, but I'll give you a letter that states what your compounded annual growth rate is, but you can't use it for promotion or marketing or this or that and the other, because a full audit was too expensive.
Yeah.
And my 20-year compounded annual growth rate at that time, known as CAGR, was, I think it was 22.3% for 20 years. It's grown to about 26% over the last 25 years. And that is, I believe, quite good. So so that was one of the chapters where my Wall Street was born, that there was somebody willing to say, look, go get this checked. Because in my mind, I was an engineering manager. Mm. I was a technology guy who thought all night and day about stock market. Literally, if you saw me staring out the window, I was thinking of stock market. From that day to this. So I had a letter that said I had a reasonable track history. I had John, and John and I had insights from what people actually want and what they need. So everyone enjoys education, but they don't have to think at the end. And then I had a long-term relationship as a stock analyst with the giant of the industry, the Motley Fool, for whom I worked, for probably 10 plus years as a stock analyst. So John and I hopped on a plane I think I Facebook messaged Tom Gardner, who's one of the co-founders of Motley Fool. And I said, Tom, can I meet you? I have an idea. And John and I met, went out to Alexandria in Virginia in the US. We met the CFO of the organization, a hugely supportive individual from the first day we met him, Olin Douglas. And we met Lawrence Greenberg, the chief legal counsel of Motley Fool. And we met all these people who are part of the organization from the earliest days. And I had this ridiculously naive pitch deck. I can still embarrass myself thinking about it. And we ran through to say, we're going to get the world investing. We know mobile really well. You guys don't. We can do this really well. We can get a whole new generation of investors mobilized. And that was in the year, that was at the very end of 2013. And today in whatever, May 2021, we've about 3.5 million people using our apps, and that was great, because at least I can say to the fool, well, at least we got something done.
What did you want from them? What did you want Motley Fool to say to you?
I was willing to part with 20% of the business for $1. That's the first time I've ever said that out loud. And the reason was, like, if you do an MBA, you know, 101, they say, if you're going into a new industry in a different sector in a different country, is basically the end. Like, businesses that try and diversify, even with a product in a new product in a new market, is danger. You know, it just won't work. I was a guy, John and I were two guys here in Dublin, Ireland, with a concept to get the world investing successfully. So we'd never developed an app. We had never run a publishing business. We had never run a multimedia business. We'd never run a fintech. And what we needed above all else was credibility. And for the Motley Fool to say, we'll invest, and believe me, they didn't put a value so low on the business. They did not take 20% for a dollar. The terms they offered us, John and I were high-fiving each other all the way through Alexandria that night. You know, it was great. And to have, you know, to have a shareholder who is the dominant name, the most positive force in the world in the area, just gave us permission to come back to Ireland and raise capital here. Like, for example, if I say to people, if you're starting a yoga clothes business, go to the highest person you can find in Lululemon and be prepared to hand over a chunk of your business to that business for a penny. Because from there on in, you're the yoga guys part owned by Lululemon. And the value of that bursts open the doors. And, you know, we're all familiar with these TV shows where you pitch for money. And sometimes I see entrepreneurs missing the point. They need to, what the real point is, they're going to walk outside the door and go, we're invested in by the Dragon's Den. And that's going to bring a whole new flush of capital towards the business, because it's known and it's credible and it's entertainment and whatever. But the point is, when you're getting going, you need a credible player on your cap table, a capitalization table of shareholders. And that was the earliest days of my Wall Street. We had the backing of each other. Many entrepreneurs around Dublin. That individual I met in Ballsbridge said, I'll invest, and he invested. Mm-hmm. And then the Motley Fool are investing, and then friends and family. And they say when you raise money first, there's the three F's, friends, family, and fools. Well, the fools were the Motley Fools for me and for John. So we did our first round. We raised €750,000. We got the full extent of Enterprise Ireland's backing at the time. And we were strong enough to quit our good paying jobs in our big corporate life and go out to Nova UCD, the kind of incubation center in the main college of Ireland, and get a two-person office. I swear it was like a broom cupboard. And we were delighted. It was, you should see this place. It was literally like a broom cupboard.
There's nothing really as sweet though as that first office, that first check. Yeah, all those moments are so sweet. And I always say that to people when they're starting off, like, enjoy it. They're like, oh, I'm kind of embarrassed. I was like, no, you'll look back on this and this will be one of the proudest days. What you've given there, Emmett, is just gold. Like, I'm furiously writing notes here. We take a quick break from today's chat to talk about our partners for season 6, kirriescarstore.ie. That's carstore.ie. They're an incredible family-owned Irish brand, and that is why I love partnering with them. They have an incredible service. As the world's reopening, you might need a new car, you might need to trade up the old one, or you might even need to get your first car. Go to carstore.ie. You can search over 700 cars and you can do it all online. That is the beauty here. 24/7, you go online, you pick out the car. I like that one. Okay. You can then book a virtual viewing. You can do it through your phone. You don't have to leave the house. You can go, okay, I like that one. We're going to buy it. The beauty is they'll deliver it anywhere in Ireland for you. And if you don't like it, you can return it. No hassle. Go check them out. They're incredible people. It's a brilliant business. It's carstore.ie, or you can click the link in the description below. Now back to today's chat. The social proof element. I love that. The social proof of getting someone on board. You were so analytical about how you built this business in terms of identifying your weaknesses, plugging them with a great partner, identifying your social proof that you needed an external partner. What did you raise the money for?
Well, we knew what we were good at, but neither of us were coders. So we needed to find a coder, and you basically go to your network. We started to look around, and we met in the basement, the bar of the Westin Hotel in Dublin, the boyfriend of a young woman working in Paddy Power. And all we knew is he developed apps, and we met Alejandro, and he was our very first recruit, and he's with us from that day to this, full stack developer. So we used money to get great people. What else do we use the money for paying the rent, paying ourselves, keeping the wolves from the door, getting good people together, and to get a prototype out the door. So that cash delivered a really very, very beautiful app, which has since retired. And it was retired because it was, this is my dialogue, but it was too good. It had everything in there. It had the world's best learning library. It had videos. The Motley Fool, who didn't just invest with their dollars, but with their resources and key people, put their top analysts who produced customized videos pitching stocks, which were put inside our app. And we could see the Motley Fool wanted this to succeed. Obviously, apart from they're an inordinately kind of supportive business and understand the impact of conscious capitalism, they wanted to succeed because they had a stake in it. And they wanted to, I suppose it was R&D. And I remember Olin, their CFO, going, "Look, don't worry, this is like R&D for us, like, because this is mobile. You guys, different country, mobile only. That's all we knew." And they produced some wonderful content. It was the most beautiful looking app. But the problem, or at least the challenge, is that apps broadly should only do one thing. So when you take out open Uber, you want to press the button that gets you a cab. When you open Twitter, you want to read the stream, and then there's one button where you can write a tweet. And this app had everything. It had learning library, it had advice, it had brokerage capability. We'd integrated. John and I had spoken or met with the founders of Robinhood, who are a big broker on the West Coast, and we'd integrated their tech into ours, and it was just like the car that Homer Simpson built, but it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. I lament the fact that we had to retire it. We bifurcated it. We said, right, we're building two apps. One is purely for learning, and one is learning by doing. And that approach has manifested itself right through from whatever, 2015, I suppose, to now.
I think that's a really important lesson, just to talk on that for a second, the power of simplicity. I think a lot of first-time founders, and a lot of founders in general, we overbuild everything. It's going to be the best. It's going to have everything. But what you just said there about doing one thing and doing it well, I think that applies if you're opening a bakery or if you're opening an app. It's the same principle of just the power of simplicity. In the early days, so you had your developer, you two guys out in Nova. Mm-hmm. What happened next?
Well, John convinced me. I was totally bullheaded. I said, "We don't need a writer. I'm the writer, John." And he was, "No, we need someone. We need a copywriter." He eventually said, "Look, Emmett, you can't do all the writing. And apart from anything, I'm not a trained writer. I give it a shot. And I guess by doing it for so many years now, it's not awful, but we wanted somebody who was eloquent and trained in writing and effectively an outstanding journalist with a hunger for the subject that we were out to conquer. And we did a few interviews. We put a job advertisement out, I can't remember where, and interviewed a pile of people. But one individual just stood out. Like the subject was write as a piece on any stock you like, any length, just write a piece. And what we decided was we'd read these pieces and find, is there a cultural fit? Have they a kind of a lightheartedness to the subject, which was really what we were out to do. Like everything My Wall Street does is surrounded by a principle that we are jargon free. We don't speak the Wall Street jargon to people because it's frankly ridiculous. You know, anything can be explained to a child. And so we were jargon free, but we got a few submissions in, and there was one piece that stood out, and it was called One Up on Wally Street, which is a play on obviously Wally, which was the hit Pixar movie at the time, and a seminal book written by an investor called Peter Lynch called One Up on Wall Street. And even that headline alone, I thought was so playful. And and Rory, who wrote the piece, put a nice picture of Wally on Wall Street, which I thought was great. And then he proceeded to analyze Pixar as a stock. And we met Rory, and Rory, like Alejandro, has been with us from that day to this. And I used to look at The Motley Fool, as I mentioned, and apart from having contributed to them for a period of time, I could see they had some analysts. And I was wondering, how did they find someone so ridiculously gifted at this subject? And lo and behold, our second recruit, which was Rory, came from the same ilk. He had a kind of an insatiable appetite for reading. When Rory started, all he wanted me to do was throw books at him. I had finished, I'd given him all the books I'd read on the subject, and he was more. He was a reader, he's a thinker, he is a very deep thinker. But he manages with his depth of thinking to bring it up to the One Up on Wally Street level, which doesn't take away from the most important information, but he presents information outwards in a very beautiful way. And that is, and just as I'm as grateful that John is, you know, by my side, I'm equally grateful that Alejandro and Rory are there, because they're just so gifted, and we got lucky. And of course we had lots of other people along the way who joined and left, or like we kind of politely asked, would you mind leaving, you know, depending. But we are a business that strives for excellence. Anyone who joins My Wall Street needs to have a track history of absolute excellence. And like Bill Gates said, that one great coder is worth more than 100 good coders. Mm. And that kind of stuck in mine and John's mind. And we've carried that through. And I'm very happy to work with so many talented people. And they're all shareholders on My Wall Street.
Interesting. So what was your next steps in terms of what were you selling to people, essentially, I suppose, what I'm asking you?
We didn't know. We built, so our Learn app was free, and that is, it's still on the App Store. We've kind of improved it somewhat over the years, but this came from the guidance we had from The Fool, which is you have to earn trust. You have to give away a lot of really quality information free of charge in order to be noticed. And the way we did that was we appified the very course that I gave in the hotel in Ballsbridge. And that's a wonderful product. To this day, like we get such a sense of satisfaction and gratitude that this app is used by schools across the Philippines, children in the Solomon Islands, top business colleges in America. In any month, it would have 40 to 50,000 downloads. And we have never spent one penny promoting it. Nothing, zero. And that is wonderful, because it shows that by doing something powerful and good and giving it away with no hooks and put your in your email and here, click here to unlock that and pay us the money, by just putting it out there, it got ranked number one by Apple on the App Store and by Google eventually on the Play Store. In its category, pretty much all over the world. And John and I had an interaction with the boss of Bank of New York Mellon. And Bank of New York Mellon at the time was housed on, its address was 1 Wall Street, New York City. And we stood outside the front door of Bank of New York Mellon with the boss, whose name I'll hold back because he also invested in My Wall Street. And the boss said, so how do I find this app? And we said, well, go look for it. And he opened his phone and he typed in stock investing. And there was our app, to our great relief, in number one spot. And we stood on Wall Street. And there we were looking at the boss of one of the biggest banks in the world with an app that we had developed with our team in top spot. And we got such a rush from that. It was more high fives, except this time, instead of in Alexandria, Virginia, it was in New York City. So we gave something away of true value. And then our flagship product, My Wall Street, we tweaked that, and we weren't sure how to monetize. You can make a fine living giving away everything for nothing, but only for a short time. And we had our first kind of Ferrari into commercialization was you to click to pay for stock of the month, our favorite stock to buy right now on a per purchase basis. But, you know, that's the fast track to ruination. And I think we only charge like $2, and it takes a lot of $2 to pay all the wages. Mm-hmm. So we experimented, and one of the things we are data guys. We both come from a background of maths and engineering and science, and we don't convince ourselves with stories. We convince ourselves with numbers. I sometimes wish we'd gotten to the bottom line a little faster. We wanted more data, but it's worked out. And what we have now is an absolutely wonderful product, My Wall Street app. I've said, and our customers tell us, I believe the best return on investment anyone will ever make in their investing life, because it's $100 a year. And what makes it special is that Rory and his team, and me on occasion leaning in, but really it's Rory and his team, will filter down to somewhat 7,000 listed companies that exist on the 2-3 big exchanges in the US, down to a short list of around 120. And you can go and find any stock you want in the My Wall Street app, but we put an analysis on the ones we believe are best suited for the normal average retail investor who doesn't want to think. And then on the first Monday of every month, Rory writes up stock of the month, which is the one he believes is the best to buy right now. And the reason that's a really, truly wonderful service for just $100 a year is that it has outperformed the S&P 500's returns, which is the benchmark index, sevenfold, which is like unbelievable. That's like finding a cat that speaks Japanese. Like, that is like, and this isn't, by the way, 2 or 3 months of data. I'm talking 5 years of data. So I've occasionally been asked, where's my crystal ball? And if it isn't here under my desk, it's over at Rory's, because he is really good.
Those returns are huge. There's no kind of two ways of sugarcoating that. Were you ever tempted to start your own fund?
Yeah. And we were asked this question so often. There's loads of fund managers. Mm. Oh, snore, how boring. I mean, how, like, we are going to create 1 billion successful investors. Yeah. So, Gary, that is the unwavering fact of My Wall Street. Now, the thing, when I say that in acknowledgement that I might not be around when we hit the billion number, but I'm not building a business because I want to run a fund. I'm not building a business because I want a bigger car or a yacht or a house tennis. We are out to get the world investing successfully. This is a purpose-driven business. There is absolutely, you do not change the world by starting a fund. I mean, we're creating, as I said, a new generation, and our purpose simply is to inspire people to own their financial future. Because it's easy. There's no great mystery. So you can start a fund, of course. We could be rolling in the cash. I have no question about that. Or no doubts about that, I mean, say. So, like, but it's the predictable path, but My Wall Street isn't out to do the predictable thing.
That's an incredible answer. Okay, that's that boxed off. So you experimented. I just want to touch on this because that's the whole genesis of this podcast, right? This is to get people experimenting and just trying, going from that, like, I have an idea, but everyone thinks you need to have the book written before you publish it. Very few people start to write the book now and go chapter one, chapter two, and figure it out as you go. I love the fact you did that. I didn't know that that's how it happened, but this is even better. How did you go about that process? You experimented a little bit, different types of monetization, and how did you keep the faith during that process?
Yeah, well, there were a lot of moments of doubt. There's no question about it. I mean, I get on mic here, I speak with you, and I trivialize the difficult phases. But there were moments where we were nearly out of money and couldn't demonstrate to our backers that we had figured out at least how to make it. And that's difficult. I remember one morning a few years ago, waking, as you do when you're nearly out of money as an entrepreneur, very, very early, like 4 a.m. And only John and I knew, you know, the extent of the troubles we were in. And, so I got up and I decided I'm going to go for a walk. And I went out and I walked down and walked down. I got to Dunleary, which you know where that is, Gary. So we got to Dunleary Pier and I started walking down Dunleary Pier. It was about 5 a.m. at this stage. And I saw this vision running towards me. And it was the radio broadcaster in Ireland, Bobby Kerr, who I'm sure you know.
Of course.
And Bobby ran past. It was a good morning. And I walked to the end of the pier and I sat at the end of the pier looking out at the sea going, how am I going to get out of this mess? Mm-hmm. I've put my name, my reputation, everyone who believed in me, and we're out of money and the product is not making any money. And that was that chapter. And, you know, got home and got on with it. And then lo and behold, a white knight of an investor arrived and capitalized the business. And 3 weeks later, we were back in business in a very meaningful way because it was a big investment.
When was this, Emmett? Sorry to interrupt you.
I'm going to say this was about 5 years ago, maybe. Okay. Yeah. So we were kind of at it about 4 years ago, so between 4 and 5 years ago, but we were at it a couple of years. We had iterated and changed. And one thing we kept doing is releasing a new app, looking at the data, tweaking that, releasing a new app, looking at data, and so on and so on. You have to obsess on the data. And we were zeroing in on the model. We knew we were. But that was not expressing itself on graphs. So when an investor says, right, so show me your traction, they want to see a curve. And that curve was flat. It wasn't a curve, it was a line. And but this one particular investor, and the two investors actually who worked together, came in, recapitalized the business in a significant way, and we were through the gap. So I got a phone call and it was like, hey, do you want to come in and speak to Bobby Kerr on the radio show? I forget what the name of the show is or was. He had a business show on News Talk. And I said, yeah, brilliant. So I went in and I'm sitting in the waiting area of News Talk and Bobby came down and he said, how are you doing? I said, nice to meet you, Bobby. And we shook hands because your face looks familiar. And I said, yeah. I said, you ran past me on Dunleary Pier about 4 weeks ago. And he goes, oh, were you out of money? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I knew by you. He said, I know that look. You had that look of an entrepreneur who'd basically hit the rocks.
No way.
And he goes, I know that feeling. And I think now, obviously, I don't know if I'm imagining this. Pretty sure he told me that Insomnia was named, his coffee chain was named after not the fact that coffee keeps you awake, but that business keeps you awake. And he made a comment to that effect. But it was such a kick to actually meet the man on the other side of the problems, you know?
Yeah, it's beautiful. And the longer you're in business, the more those kind of little serendipity moments happen. You're like, oh, that's just what I needed. It's very funny.
Yeah.
That's sometimes that little like, oh, that's, you know what? It's not major. It's not like, oh, here's a million euro. But just that little kind of acknowledgement of like, oh, you get it.
Yes.
You get it too.
Yeah. I mean, I feel this great sense of gratitude to everyone who supported me and JT and Rory and Alejandro and the team. I walk around with a feeling of gratitude. I could list in a most boring of ways, everyone who said something that or did something that helped us onwards, because there are very, very, very few business to consumer companies in Ireland in the software space that have been a success. I don't know any. Now, I'm sure your listeners will write in, but B2C software companies that are known the world over and are multi-billion dollar businesses, I don't know. Maybe there is one. Stripe is obviously a huge success. It's not quite B2C, so it's B2B. But I do feel this great sense of gratitude. Every day I'm walking around with it. And even now I speak to shareholders on my Wall Street who really did take a bet on two guys with a PowerPoint that was printed out and stuffed under their arm walking around the city.
You can feel it coming off you though. You can feel A, passion for what you do, and B, that kind of satisfaction and happiness that you're doing something that you enjoy. what was the moment when it all started to turn around? So thank you for sharing that story. I think that's very powerful to hear, because, you know, it can often, you hear these stories of founders and, oh, it all went well and blah, 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 and all up and to the right. So thank you for sharing that. What started working?
Well, we eventually landed on the monetization formula that works. So my Wall Street, it's not profitable yet. We still spend more than we take in. And that guilt that I mentioned to you earlier that existed in that hotel room 15 years ago, Irish guilt, I don't know what name label you want to give it, where John and I handed over all this profit over to a charitable organization. Like, kind of, we had to get rid of that. We had to realize that, well, it's fine. We're out to make a profit and we have to accelerate revenue. So I think things started to look better. I mean, it's no bed of roses. On any one day, I can tell you a list of problems, the problems of the moment. But for the last 6 quarters, for the last 18 months, revenue has grown every single month quite substantially. And that means that that curve that I mentioned earlier that used to be a flat line is in fact a curve. And it just, a child could look at the pattern and see the business is pointing in the right direction.
So what's been happening? We're going full circle now. We talked about it at the very start, 2020, 2021. What's been happening for you? And then how is that represented in the wider world?
What do you mean by that, Gary? Sorry.
In terms of the last 12 to 18 months have been crazy. Okay. We've had COVID. We've had everything going sideways.
Yes.
It's been a counter story for you in terms of everything's going now up and to the right. What has changed?
Well, you know, coronavirus was, I mean, God, there's 7 billion stories about coronavirus. Every person on the planet has a view on that subject and has had a personal impact from that. I'm one of the fortunate ones where working from home is a pleasure in a functioning home and we all get along well and it's big enough that we can find our own space. So I'm one of the fortunate ones in a first world country and a part of the country that I like being in. And so I'm that gratitude I mentioned is omnipresent for me. I feel hugely grateful that I was able to get home and work from home. So at a personal level, it was fine. I was scared of getting the virus, but that's, weren't we all? The business, John and I pulled everyone together and in March, or maybe it was February of last year when the virus broke out. And I'm proud to say, I think we called it well before anyone. We said to everyone, right, we're going to work from home and there's no coming back to the office until August 2021, mm-hmm. which at that time, everyone was like, are you crazy? Are you absolutely nuts? August 2021, I mean, the general conversation was, we'll all have to go home for 2 weeks. And we've kind of revised that recently to September. So everybody went to their respective homes and we are a very culturally diverse business. Our team come from 14 different countries. So some of those people went back home, wherever home is for them. Others went back to their apartment or houses in Ireland. And we all worked from home. What we found was that it was a very effective way for us to collaborate and work between Zoom and Trello and all these different collaborative tools and Slack and all the rest. We were as good as in the same room. Like, certain dynamics are lost, but when you're working, it's quiet as opposed to being in a room full of people. So that was actually a benefit. I mean, from a structural perspective in my Wall Street, it worked. The second is that everyone was at home around the world and stimulus checks were being posted to people in the US, and these individuals lying at home on their couch were looking for something to do with it. And that was a tailwind which acted in our favor. So we had people at home, they'd opened a brokerage account, which is fine. The utility of buying a share is sorted. But next thing they're like, okay, what should I buy? And that's where people would find us. So 90%+ of people who interact with my Wall Street and who use my Wall Street found us by looking for us, organic word of mouth marketing, sister recommending to brother, recommending it to friend. So our audience of somewhat 3.5 to 4 million people, for the vast, vast majority found us. And that was aided by the fact that, people were at home, lying around, looking for something to do with this check that landed through the letterbox.
Preparation meets timing. when those holy grails align, all those years of putting it out, and suddenly,
yeah,
it just snaps.
That's right. Right. I mean, we also got smart. We figured that our flagship product, My Wall Street, the default way to subscribe is you pay per month, which offers people 12 opportunities a year to quit. Mm. In fact, they have to resubscribe. And that's, am I right in saying that? Yeah, you get an email from Apple saying we're taking a tenner off you tomorrow. So we just changed a few things that the default was you subscribe for a year. We experimented extensively on the positioning of that and the price point and new products. And we got a little bit more commercially savvy. And that helped as well.
Yeah, it's funny. I like the experimentation. And so you went to a yearly pricing, and did that have a massive impact?
Yeah, did. Huge impact. Yeah, only the giants. We only the giants like Netflix, where people will ignore Spotify or Netflix or maybe Apple Music, and they'll put it down as a cost of living because these are utility entertainment vehicles, especially in the times we're in. But for anything else, people dread monthly bills. Mm. They just hate them. Like, everybody has a noise level of resentment for a monthly bill, whether it's your broadband, your mobile phone, your all these things that stack up. So people would rather just know it's paid up for a year. And I tell you one thing, we would prefer it as well as a business.
Yeah, it's psychology. It's pure psychology. You know, you get that little pain going, do I need that? Do I subscribe? Mm. And I'd imagine with your service, it is something that compounds over time, like good investing. It is something you need to be bought in on for a minimum, I would imagine, of a year.
Oh, absolutely. You nailed that, Gary. I mean, that is the one thing about stock investing is that there's really just, we've compressed it down to six golden rules. There's six golden rules in investing, and one of them is you have to go long or think long term. So we have six golden rules. Second one is think long term, which is a buy and hold philosophy is the way to beat the market.
Well, you got to tell us the rest of them now. You've started.
Well, so the six golden rules weren't just pulled out of thin air. When John and I started the business, we sat in his kitchen and we did all our mission, our vision, our values, our philosophy, our culture. And John said, now we better get out of your head how you pick stocks. You know, your point of failure. I was like, thanks a million. So I scribbled down a draft set of golden rules and went off to find academic proof for each of them. And it wasn't just from cold. I'd obviously been thinking and writing and teaching on the subject for quite a while. But the six golden rules that an investor must adhere to succeed are as follows. Number one, get started. Okay, I didn't have any academic backing on that one, but it's no point. You have to get started. So the most important step in your investing journey is the first one. And what My Wall Street does is helps you get started and guides you every step of the way after that. And there's a huge relationship that's forged in your brain with your first anything, your first album, your first team, your first musical instrument, your first brother or sister, your first love. These things are stuck in your mind. And the first stock you buy goes into the same compartment in your brain. And get started is the first golden rule. It's self-explanatory. The second, as I mentioned, is thinking long-term. And there is no great investor that I know of who made a name by being a day trader or a swing trader or a momentum trader. The people who are brand names as investors think long term. And it's a buy and hold philosophy that outperforms the market in the long term. And we help people to become successful long term investors. So everything we do is built around thinking long-term. In fact, everything we do is built around the six golden rules. So the third golden rule, so first one is get started. Second is think long-term. The third is never borrow money to buy, ever. And that was learned by me the hard way in the run-up to the dot-com bubble in the late 90s. It was going great for me. there was no stock that just wasn't going to the stars, and I was jumping in. And my broker at the time, Daytech, like every other broker from that day to this and long before it, will extend you a loan, which is known as margins, which is, here's some more money, go buy more. By the way, if that thing starts to come near what you owe us, we start to sell it, which is fair enough. So I had bought I borrowed an awful lot of money from my broker in the late 90s. I was 26 years of age. And in the year 2000, in early 2000, when the dot-com bubble burst, I was 26 and I lost it all. I'd lost my shirt. And that was because I had borrowed to buy. So debt cuts both ways. It's grand if you're buying a house and you get a mortgage and it's a long-term thing. That's a different category. But what we say is save first, then invest. It's the one of the best ways to maximize your success in the market. So the third golden rule is never borrow money to buy, because that has to be paid back. The fourth golden rule is diversify, which speaks for itself. And any successful investor ever has said you must diversify. Don't put all your eggs in one basket, buy a portfolio of shares. If you speak to an art collector, they don't just buy the art of one artist. You speak to a wine collector, they say the same. You speak to a classic car collector, they say the same. So you got to just build up a portfolio. And we say you should have at least 12 stocks across different markets and sectors, which is a key success factor. Our fifth golden rule, Gary, is buy what you believe in. And this is a really important one. And I think in Ireland, anyone over the age of, I guess, maybe 40 will remember there was a frenzy for, let's say, buying apartments abroad. And I remember once my barber telling me to buy apartments in Bulgaria, and he was picking them up for 30K a pop. And this FOMO was building up. But like, if you'd asked me at that time to drop a pin on Bulgaria on the map, I'd have got it wrong by 1,000 miles. So so you have to buy what you believe in. There's no point in investing your hard-earned capital in something that fundamentally skews with your value set or your general beliefs. So you have to kind of just say, yeah, I totally believe, because a well-formed portfolio is your autobiography. If I showed you all the stocks that I own, it in part is kind of telling you what my vision of the future is. So you have to buy what you believe in. And then the sixth and final golden rule is you invest what you can when you can. And the successful investing is built around good habits. And we help you incorporate the best of these habits into your financial life. We don't want people missing their mortgage or skipping a holiday to buy shares. That's silly behavior. You just put away what you can when you can. Unlike a property, which is a very high capital requirement if you buy it as an investment, and a monthly charge, which must be furnished in some way, the stock market asks nothing of you. Once you've not borrowed money, just put away what you can. So those six golden rules, Gary, are get started, think long-term, never borrow to buy, diversify, buy what you believe in, and invest what you can when you can.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. I think that'll be very, very beneficial to a lot of people listening who are starting to think. I think a lot of people are now starting to think about getting involved. I have one last question for you, and it should be an easy one, judging by the vista I'm looking at behind you. Can you recommend a book that's made, you can mean a book or books that has made an impact on you professionally or personally?
Well, I mean, I'd love to give you an intellectual answer like Human Ultihuman by Friedrich Nietzsche or something like that. I mean, my favorite investing books are the unofficial biography of Warren Buffett, which is called The Making of an American Capitalist by Roger Lowstein. I think it is. That's a great story. I mean, there was other ones written like Snowball, which is a tome, but this one is a really nice story about Warren Buffett. Then there's One Up on Wall Street, which I mentioned to you earlier on Rory's play on words, One Up on Wally Street, written by investing legend Peter Lynch. And then I have a long list. I've read dozens or perhaps hundreds of investing books, but they're the ones I'd pick up and look at again from a kind of non-investing like impact on my life. At a stage in my life, I was highly impacted by the books of Ian Banks, a Scottish author who wrote science fiction under the name Ian M. Banks and then dramatized fiction under Ian Banks. Loved his books, just had a lovely turn of phrase. I'm a big fan of Bill Bryson. I've read everything he's written, and I absolutely love his books. Not a very unique insight there, because a lot of people have. So we, I don't read as much as I used to. I used to get through 2 books a month. It's down to about 1 a month at the moment, aided somewhat by Audible. But yeah, I will always have a lifelong relationship with books, but they're the ones that have had an impact on me.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Emmett. Emmett, where can people learn more about My Wall Street and more about yourself?
Well, this is probably the most exhaustive interview I've ever given. So
I'm delighted to hear that. I love when people say that.
I really don't know where they should go to hear more about me other than
re-listen.
Here.
Go back to the start and re-listen.
From My Wall Street, yeah, absolutely. You open up your phone, you go to the App Store and you type in My Wall Street and you download it. Get started. It's the first golden rule. It is the greatest investment anyone will make in their lives once they obey those 6 golden rules. So the App Store, type in My Wall Street, or just go to mywallstreet.com.
Beautiful. Emmett, thank you so much for sharing your great story with us today.
Thanks, Gary. Delighted to be on the show and look forward to seeing you again soon.
You made it right to the end. Thank you for staying and listening to the outro. If you go to refer.fm/experiment, you can now refer the pod to friends of yours and pick up some Entrepreneur Experiment merch or even have a chat with me. So go refer the pod, send me a tweet, tell me you did it, or send me an email. If you have any feedback on the pod, do get in touch. Go to mrgaryfox.com. You can reach me directly there. Or if you feel I can help you out with anything, shoot me a message. I will see you back here next Monday for The Idea Lab. Have a great week.